Welcome to another captivating episode of the Global Sales Leader Podcast. I'm your host, and today we have another truly exceptional guest with us, Alan Pierce. Alan's just not only a renowned author of a best-selling book, Body Language, but he's also a leading expert in the subtle art of nonverbal communication. And in this episode, Alan will open your eyes to the immense power of body language in the world of sales. Did you notice a staggering 60 to 80% of communication is conveyed non-verbally? According to some studies anyway, but Alan will take us on a journey into the dynamic world of posture, eye contact, facial expressions, and how to influence the way we are perceived by others. So this is another exceptional episode of the Global Sales Leader Podcast. Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. And wherever you are in this wide, wonderful, beautiful world that we live in, you are very welcome to the Global Sales Leader Podcast. My name is Jason Cooper. I am the sales relationship coach. So in the world of sales, we can often be misconstrued as transactions. I'm here to challenge the notion. The podcast is dedicated to exploring the revolutionary perspective on sales, one that centers around the authentic relationships and the role of the trusted advisor. But it's more about that. So in this podcast series, I speak to wonderful eclectic people from around the world in the area of psychology, behavior economics, body language, bit of a hint there today, and technology, and lots of different facets around that, because it's a fascinating subject, and obviously leadership as well, and sales and so on and so forth. But today I have an awesome guest. You're very welcome. Do I introduce you as Professor Alan Pierce, or how would you like to be introduced?
Oh, I don't mind. If I'm no good, it won't matter how you introduce me, Dave.
So a little bit of an introduction. Alan Pierce is Australia's most successful author. Oh, that's a bit of an accolade there. Writing 18 top 10 bestsellers, including 11 number ones. That's awesome. I like that. His books are translated into 55 languages and has sold over 30 million copies, including the definitive book of body language, which is behind me in that blue copy. But for the audio listeners, just trust me, it's blue. So why men don't listen and women can't read maps. I'm going to have to definitely read that. And why men don't have a clue and women need more shoes. The answer. I'm definitely going to have to read that. So huge accolades around here. Look, there's lots of stuff about yourself. Your research covers magazines ranging from marketing, Reader's Digest, and so on and so forth. Fellow Society of the Royal Society of Arts, Life Fellow of Institute of Learning Practitioners, and the list goes on and on and on. So you are very welcome.
Well, clearly I'm pretty old, Jason, and I'm here on the Sunshine Coast in Australia, and you're very welcome to be here too. I'm sure the crack will be 90 on this. I've been really looking forward to this thing. I knew you were coming from Ireland. So, yeah, the list does get one. In fact, I think I wrote that list we sent you, but it was going to take up half the program. So
Yeah, you did actually write that. Yeah,
after the fact.
So what got you into what you're doing? Because we were discussing just beforehand, you've been doing this since the 1970s. So what started you on the journey?
Well, I come from state housing commission, we call it in Australia, where the government builds a house because your family's got no money. So I came from a fairly poor background in country Victoria, right in the very south of Australia here. And my father was the local insurance representative for the Eagle Star Insurance Company, a good British company. And back in those days, in the 1950s, the insurance agents were the motivational guys of the day. And everybody would be supplied with a little HMV record player with these big 78 records. And my father would be supplied these by Eagle Star Insurance. They included things like How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie and Earl Nightingale. So I grew up as a kid at school listening to these with my father. And at night times and on weekends, he would take me calling on prospects as well, because back in those days, prospects were existing customers where you knew a little bit about who they were from local council roles and government electoral roles. And he'd knock on the door and he'd take me regularly after school on the weekends, because he was a young, handsome guy knocking on doors, collecting the premiums for policies. And it was mostly women answering the doors. And so you've got a kid with you, you get in.
Yeah.
Good. So I was a bit of a sales strategy, I guess, from that standpoint. And he would say things like, I remember he said things like, if they wouldn't let him in, he'd say, look, would you mind if Alan has a glass of water, please? And he'd nod his head and they go, oh, okay. Come. Or he'd say, could Alan use your toilets, please? And they'd, yes, come on in. So I spend my nights after school weekends drinking glasses of water and peeing in people's toilets all over southwest of Victoria. And at night times, listening to these records with my dad. So that's where I got started. And I got a sales job at age 11, knocking on doors, selling rubber sponges, pots and pans. And right through my whole teenagehood, through to being an adult, I was a top salesman. That's all I knew, because we had no money in the family. My dad was a salesman. He said, you've either got to go to uni and be a doctor, or you've got to be a salesman. So I said, can I do both? I'll do both. You know, it could be practical to do that. And that's where it all started. It had very practical beginnings. And in the late 60s, I was teaching a course on how to sell, how to handle objections, how to present. And part of that, Jason, was how to read people across the table. How are they with you? Are they against you? Yeah. Are they holding back? Are they being open? And that was based on the way they looked and moved and behaved. And I thought this was stuff that everybody knew. Turns out they didn't.
Yeah.
Women knew it, but they didn't know they knew it. But men, it was a bit of a revelation. And that was such a popular course back in the late 60s. And so in 1976, I released the book called Body Language, which I figured we might sell 10,000. That would be an absolute winner. We sold 6 million so far that we know of. So it's been an absolute cracker. And I've been turned into movies, turned into training courses. And it's created a whole bunch of other trainers in the world who have come from that basic route. So it had very practical beginnings, and from knocking on doors and selling.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject, that, like, body language is, I don't know where it comes from different points of view. 55% is nonverbal, or in around that variance. Like, there's lots of different research going there. So before people open their mouths, is they see you.
Well, so that's right. The current research on that, including most of ours, and most of the current research came from ours originally, shows around 60 to 80% of all the impact you make face to face is the way you look, appear, and behave. That is the impact of your message, is 2/3 to 3/4 of how you come across. The words you actually say, that is things that we can write on paper, accounts for somewhere between 7 to 10%. So what you actually say doesn't matter that much in terms of the scheme of things. And the original stat that you quoted, and you just quoted it then, was 55% nonverbal, 38% vocal, and the rest of 7%. That research was done in 1954 in America with 20-year-old Caucasian males.
Yeah.
And so it didn't have a clear cross-cultural or cross-gender impact. So today we know that across all cultures and genders, it's around 60 to 80% of the impact you make is the way you look, appear, and behave. And people form up to 90% of their impression about you on a first meeting in under 4 minutes. It means you blow the first 4 minutes, Jason, you're going to struggle to get people inside. Because one thing we do know in sales, and anybody who's been in sales for a while knows this, if people buy you, that is, they feel comfortable with, they like you, they feel like you identify with them, you're not threatening or intimidating, if they buy you, there's a fair chance they'll give you a hearing and maybe buy what goes with you. Versus trip, they don't buy you because you've got a bit of spinach stuck in your teeth or something about your appearance or behavior that I can't even pinpoint what it is, but there's something about you. They'll look for reasons to say no. So none of us are in the product business. We're really in the people business first. If they buy us, there's a fair chance they might buy what we have to say.
Yeah, and there is a lot of research behind of if you're going into a place like Google and you're dressed in a suit, there might be an automatic going, hang on, he doesn't fit into the way that we are. We're all in jeans and T-shirts and scruffy runners or trainers or whatever. So there's part of that in there as well within how you look, how you engage with people. If you're coming from an accountancy point of view and you're dressed like you come from an agency, there's a slight different disconnect as well. So,
Well, that's right. Look, about 30 years ago, this Dress Down Friday started in America, where didn't have to wear what was traditionally a coat and tie and maybe a shirt and so on that's 30 years ago, they decided we're going to have dress down Fridays. And it was the Apple types and the Googles and the Microsofts who started that, which was all very good. But the problem that they encountered with that was lines of authority. Now, you imagine if they decide to have dress down days in the police force.
Yeah.
Like nobody would know who the hell was supposed to report to who. And this is what happened in business, because suits, ties, and other business clothing, these in fact are uniforms that create a certain amount of status, rapport, and authority around them. The minute you take them all away and dress casually, like you and I are now, for example, then immediately the person who's looking at you and listening is left to try to guess how much authority do you really have, how much background and information on the subject do you really know? Whereas a suit, if I had a suit and a shirt and a tie, which I don't do much these days because audiences are getting younger. Yeah. If it was an older audience that we were playing to right now, say plus 50s, I would have a coat on, maybe not a tie. If they're over 65, I would definitely put a tie on, because that's how they identify authority of somebody who might know what they're talking about, where someone dressed like me looks like some guy in a prison cell somewhere who's giving a broadcast. So you're right. The suits, ties, business clothing is and always has been a mark of authority. And again, you relate to the police force. They say to the cops, let's have dress down. Everybody comes in casual. You'd have nothing but chaos. Put it in the armed forces. Everybody can dress down. You'd have a no army.
Yeah. And it probably leads us on to an obvious place is trust and building trust within people and having that mutual connection. So when you build trust and rapport, I know you've suggested that, which is a critical aspect of body language from your book. How can salespeople initiate trust straight away with how they come across to people? Because that's so important. Like people and brands they like, trust, and they connect with. So what's a really good way of doing that?
Well, uniforms are something you can manage. Yeah. So for example, we did a number of projects with customs and immigration in a few countries, and that we found that with a uniform on, with a tie, a male or female has much more authority and power over somebody when they don't have that on. And if they've got four stripes or four badges or four stars somewhere, again, that gives even more authority versus, say, somebody who might be the most authority person in customs who's dressed casually like you or me. They'll get fights and punch-ups from people when they're trying to interview them. So you can dress yourself in badges of authority. The way you do that is very simple. You just say to yourself, when you're calling on someone, particularly for the very first time, where you've got that 4-minute window where they're going to decide whether they're going to trust you or not effectively. In fact, most of that happens in under 10 seconds. Yeah. We spend 3:50 confirming what we think we saw. Is ask yourself the question, the person you're about to see, to convince, persuade, motivate, influence, what do they think you would look like, Jason? How would you be dressed if clearly you are an expert and authority and I should listen to you? And so, if you go dressed based on how you're feeling that day, and this is where women can get into trouble with this, because a woman might say, I'm feeling a bit red today, or I'm feeling blue, and they'll dress according to that, which may have no relevance to the person they're trying to persuade. So dress the way they would expect you to look if clearly you have the authority and ability to say. That's the first thing. Secondly, that we trust and feel comfortable with people who are like us.
Yeah.
So if you've got a partner and a couple of kids and you drive a standard four-door Toyota and somebody turns up the gap, well, you're more likely to trust them because clearly they think like you, look like you, because it's a form of mirroring.
Yeah.
And they're mirroring you. And so that being the case, one of the ways to subtly get people to feel trustworthy and to feel as though they'll give you a fair hearing, because look, in selling, it's not really about the sales skills. It's about somebody feeling comfortable enough to give you a fair go. If they give you a fair hearing, even if you're hopeless at selling, the law of averages will take over and one in so many will buy anyway.
Yeah.
So by mirroring people subtly, so as they talk, if they're nodding their head in groups of three, which I'm doing now, you nod your head. If they tilt their head with a listening, you tilt your head. If they sit back, when they ask something, you sit back. And by subtly mirroring, you've got to make sure you don't do it as they do it, because people will pick up on this and say, are you copying me?
Yeah.
You just wait a second or two or three, then you mirror, then whatever hand gestures they're using when they speak, you mirror that. And pretty quickly, they get a feeling, something about you they like. I can't pinpoint what it is, Jason, but, you know, when we first met, I just kind of felt comfortable and you seem like a decent sort of a person who seems to know what he's talking about. And that's the air that you want to create. If you're wearing a uniform to match their expectations of authority and expertise, that can enhance it even more.
Yeah, there's a the mirroring is fascinating in that, because people like people like themselves. So the more you can be similar to them in their ways and mannerisms, but obviously it's to practice this, but not mimicry, because mimicry is can also do it to the adverse effect, where you know they know that you're copying them. But the way I like to do it is to study people in coffee shops and bars and pubs, and two friends sitting together, or husband and wife, and it's fascinating to watch, because you soon notice they're in congruence with each other. Their body language is exactly the same. Their head's tilting forward or back or whatever. But also their tone, their tonality, and everything else comes in line with that as well. And the other thing is the way they speak. And the colonial, I think it's called the colonialisms. I'm not sure whether I made that up completely or whether it's a saying, but it is that they say the certain words this exactly the same way.
Well, not only that, if you look at couples that are really getting into each other, and you see this in full-on bloom love, you know, they've been together 6 months and they're right into each other. That first area in the first 9 months of relationships where hormones are flooding the brain and they can't make logical, rational decisions in their own best interest. We call that the strait of the bonkerama. That's the first 6 to 9 months. And if you watch couples in a restaurant who are in that phase, you might see things like she takes a sip of red wine and he picks up a napkin and wipes his mouth.
Yeah.
Or she cuts a little bit of meal, puts it in her mouth, and then he rubs his stomach. In other words, that they've almost in sync, as though they're one person. They become one personality. And that is the ultimate mirroring in many aspects. But you can do this on purpose. But the important thing is that as I'm looking at you now, and unless you do gesture with your hands a lot, so as you gesture, I won't copy at the same time, because you'll think, hey, this guy's copying me. What I'll do is when I talk, I'll use the same type of gestures. So when you look at me, you'll be thinking, this guy is like me. In fact, look, I'll just put my glasses on here. That's better. Now we've both got our glasses on.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to see you.
I look a bit like Dame Ender with mine on. So your mirroring is, it's the great thing about it, you can intentionally copy it. But when you start to put techniques like this into your repertoire of persuasion influence, a lot of people get pretty nervous about when they're doing this. They go, oh, they know what I'm doing. No, they don't. Yeah, but they know I'm copying, because it feels uncomfortable. You've never done it before. It feels uncomfortable when you start to do it. So you assume that they know the other person knows what's going on. They don't. They just get a feeling something about you they kind of like. And what they kind of like is that they see themselves reflected in you, because body language is simply an outward expression of emotional condition. In other words, whatever emotions you're feeling, happy, sad, confident, defeated, proud, angry, whatever it is, it's likely to be reflected in gestures, movements, postures, and expressions. So the art of reading body language is you're simply reading a person's emotional condition, how they're feeling, in other words. You then match it up with what you hear them saying in the circumstances and context under which it's all happening. And that allows you, when you get to be pretty good at this, to kind of figure out what could be going through their minds.
Yeah.
And the average female brain person is 2 to 3 times better than the male brain person at doing this. And which is why we tell men, you don't lie to women to their face, ones who know you. I mean, can you lie to women to their face? Even the smallest lie, Jason, come on, be honest. Can you lie to their face if they know you? It's a waste of time, right?
Yeah,
I'd love to do it with Barbara. I can't. I'll try it. She said, how do you like my new earrings? And let's see, I hate them. I go, oh, yeah, all right. If I know it's good for me, I'm going to pay some sort of complimentary thing or a pseudo complimentary thing. And she'll look at me and she'll say, you've got the crap lip. Apparently, there's some small gesture. I've never seen it, but there's some gesture I make when I'm not really being sincere that women pick these things up and spot them. So the bottom line is, don't lie to women to their face. Yeah. Call them on the phone, SMS, but don't go face to face.
Yeah, I've read about that. And I think you have to just be honest as well, because women are a lot more intuitive than men. Men, you have to really, men have to really practice at the micro expressions and everything else like that, but women just pick it up like that, whether it's an intuitive thing, whether it's that trust connection, or whatever it is. the thing that I was thinking about as you were speaking is, you know, when you first meet a potential customer and buyer, there's also that resistance as well, because they know you're going there to sell to them. But from a buyer's perspective, there's also that a little bit of resistance as well. And we spoke about mirroring gestures, not to mimic them, but using sort of nonverbal cues to get onto the mirror neurons in the frontal lobe, how we can get that. But what else could we possibly do to get, just to get with them quicker and get them to go, I really like, trust, and connect with that person. And there's lots of facets around that.
Absolutely. In fact, the good thing about the first 4 minutes that allows you, there are things that you can practice. You can repeat and practice with your friends, with your mates, with your buddies, till it starts to feel comfortable and natural, because that first 4 minutes is a critical thing. If you don't sell yourself, you're going to struggle to get them on side, and they're likely to start looking for reasons to say no. But that's what we do. We look for reasons to say no with anybody, with any proposition. Jason, we're going to see them, right? We're going to see reasons to say no. Well, we want to look for reasons to say yes. And if they like us and they buy us, there's a good chance that that could well happen. So in that first 4 minutes, some of the things that might happen. Well, now that COVID's hopefully in the past, you know, during COVID, handshaking and close greeting all stopped.
Yeah.
Except for Italy, where they kept doing it and they all kicked the bucket over there because they just wouldn't stop kissing each other on greetings in churches and singing in each other's faces. But handshaking now has made a resurrection. But one of the interesting things we've discovered with handshaking, it's been going for at least 4,000 years that we know of. It's carved on coins and carved in buildings back 4,000 years ago, and back in the Roman and pre-Roman era. One of the things that we found interesting with COVID is that around 25% of women, about one in four, never wanted to shake hands before COVID.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they didn't have to, because they were forced to by us as men particularly, but we put our hand out to shake hands so they had to respond. We found that about a quarter of women didn't want to shake hands to start with. And that's an interesting thing to keep in mind, because sometimes you're likely to approach a person, and if you're a man, and it's going to be a woman, particularly is where this happens mostly. If she doesn't want to shake hands, you've got to make sure you don't force her into it, but you can do something else, other subtle things, which I'll come to in a second. So when you're shaking hands for the first time, the key to creating rapport to make a person feel comfortable is keep the palms straight. See, my palms straight. The more down it goes, the more power and authority and force you're putting into it. And your hand facing down is four times as powerful as when it's up. And so keep the palm absolutely straight is the first thing. And then this next part takes a bit of practice to give the same pressure you receive. So let's say on a scale of 1 to 10 of pressure, let's say a 10 is a knuckle grinder.
Yep.
And a 1 is four breakfast sausages. So my default position is about a 7. I don't know what yours is, because we haven't physically met. So if I meet you and your handshake was say was a 9, I'd have to pick up 20% of my power. Otherwise, your hand would naturally just rotate slightly on top, and neither of us would consciously know it. We'd get it at a gut level. You'd say, "Hello, I think I can be in charge a bit here," and I'd be thinking, "Hello, he's coming on a bit strong." So by me increasing from 7 to 10 in pressure, it stops you turning the hand over. It also communicates that we're going to be on an equal basis as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Now the reverse is true also. Let's say I've got a 7 in my pressure and I meet you, and let's say you had a 5. And now if I give you a 7, you're instantly going to start thinking, oh, he's coming on a bit strong, this fella. So what I would do, I'd back off 20% and shake your hand at 20% with the palm straight. And you would say, there's something about this guy I like. I don't know what it is, but the moment we met, we just kind of seemed to click. We seemed to click. There's no seem to click. There are specific things happening that are creating that click, if you like, and you can practice most of these. And this is one of them. Keeping the palm straight. Give the same pressure, receive.
Yeah, I thought about that before, and I'm not sure about you, but sometimes we get these, I call it a wet lettuce handshake, where it's all sweaty and it's like, it's exactly like that. And for all the ordinary listeners, it's
a really
loose, very loose, sweaty handshake. So do you copy that or just give it a looser handshake?
If someone's giving you a dead fish or giving you a number two, a very soft one, that's because that's how they feel as a person. They feel loose and soft. They're not out there to try to knuckle grind someone. So if I'm a seven and you give me a two, I'll back right back to a two.
Yeah.
Still hold on to your hand, but I'll back right back to a two. So you'll feel instantly you'll say, oh, he seems like a nice sort of a guy. You don't even know why you're saying that, but just I seem like a nice guy because I haven't squeezed your hand. But someone with a number two pressure meets somebody with a number nine, you're asking for trouble right from the start because the origin of handshake started like this in arm wrestling. The person whose hand was most on top in the Roman era was said to have the upper hand. The upper hand means that they won. And as a leader, because it was always done between leaders of troops and the armies, and they were always men. And if I can get your hand down with mine on top, I have the upper hand. My guys get the first crack at the food, the wine, the dancing, and everything else. Your guys have to wait their turn. So the idea was to never give and keep your palm straight and look them right in the eye, which is what my dad taught me when I was six, which was a very British society back in the mid-1950s. And he said, son, I'll teach you how to shake hands. You give a nice firm grip. And he'd be saying, a bit stronger, son, nice firm grip. Look them right in the eye. And that goes back to the Roman era. Now, in places like Australia, only 27% of population here is in any way British related. The rest are immigrant related.
That's right.
Largely Asian too. So if you go to Asia, to China or even Japan or Vietnam or any of those Asian countries where handshaking has never been part of the revolution. So if they're not used to meeting Westerners and shaking hands or Europeans and shaking hands, if you put your hand out to shake hands, they are likely to give you a dead fish because they don't really know what they're supposed to do because they're probably going to use either a Y or some form of body lowering or bowing as a greeting signal. And so they might have seen it all happen on TV or in the movies, but they've never experienced it within their own culture. And so there are cultural implications here that if I can think of one Chinese guy I met, he had a brown suit on, which is about as bad as it gets in the West. The West, a guy or woman with a brown suit, you know, we're not going to listen to what they say because clearly they look like something that goes into the toilet. However, in places like India and China, brown suit is quite an authoritative suit.
It is, yeah.
Yep. And so I can remember this Chinese guy I met him. He's only very short. He had a brown suit on and a dead fish handshake. Yet this guy was a multi-billionaire with enormous power in his company. Now, if you didn't know that, you're likely to instinctively think as a Westerner or a Western European, this guy's a bit of a wimp, you know, he hasn't got much going for him at all, yet the guy was in fact a powerhouse. So there are definitely cultural implications. Again, the key is mirror the strength, mirror the handshake. If you're mirroring everything, mirroring the amount of eye contact that you're getting and receiving, then you're not likely to go too far wrong.
So what are the differences been? Because I worked in Google for a bit and I was speaking to global teams, but to be connected to someone else on a multicultural basis, there are slight differences, but I understand the body language is the same, like hand gestures from what I've read. If you see the hands, shows a lot more trust. And if the hands down, it shows a little bit less.
Same with monkeys and chimps. It's primate gesture.
Mm. Yeah, exactly the same. So how can global teams now sort of make that connection with multicultural differences? But it is it's language, really.
Well, whether you're meeting him face-to-face or doing it, say, in a cast like we're doing right now, some people can see us. The rest are listening on audio, which is they're at a greater disadvantage because they haven't got that 60 to 80% medium that you and I have to be able to bounce off each other. If somebody is from another culture, what you need to practice and do in a multicultural world is whatever culture it is you might be selling to. So if you're selling to the Chinese or selling to the Arabs or selling to the Dutch or selling to the Russian-speaking community, is to learn the basic phrases of hello, goodbye, thank you, and excuse me. And some of the phrases that they might say, and I use one with you right at the very start, you probably noticed it. So you're very welcome too, because you're very welcome is a peculiarly Irish expression. You're very welcome. And it always makes you, as an Aussie, I feel good going to Ireland because I always feel like I'm very welcome as they say it. And I said, you're very welcome here and the crack will be 90, which as you would know from living in Ireland, that is an Irish expression that means we're going to have a lot of fun here. The crack will be 90. Those who heard it not always say, what the hell is this guy talking about?
It means something different in America.
Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, yeah. In America, it's totally different. You've got to make sure you don't do that in America. It's like two fingers, index finger and middle finger up in England is still up yours, whereas in America it's two.
That's
so,
right. Yeah.
Give me two, and I've just told you to go and get whatever that word was. And so, by learning basic cultural phrases, and I've got these in about at least 10 basic cultures and languages so that I would visit regularly. So I can say "Доброе утро, спасибо" in Russian. I don't speak a lot of Russian, but I know enough. So they go, "Hey, this guy has spent the time to learn the words, to practice the accent, to know the gestures." When I go to Italy, which I was in Italy 2 weeks ago, and I'm talking to Italians, I know what a nose touch means, a tooth flick and a chin flick and an ear pull, which you don't see in most other places. They're peculiarly to that cultural region of Italy. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, they think this guy has thought enough of us that he's gone to learn the expressions, the phrases, grazie, how to say things in our language and gesture. And instantly I find I get accepted by people because I'm not just another rude Westerner who's there wondering why the hell they don't speak English.
Yeah. No, and the Italians have they're probably like the Irish in a way that they use a lot of hand gestures.
The Italians. Well, you know, I did a television show some time ago. We did this back in the 80s, the first one. We got two Italians. They were the relatives of a couple of Italian-Australian friends of ours. I had a television show here, and they were Italian in town. Didn't speak that much English, just enough to get by. And we put them on the TV show, and we said, look, what we want you to do is to describe your holiday in Australia, where you've been, how you like it. And we handcuffed them with their hands behind their back. They could not describe where they'd been or what they'd done. It was hilariously funny because Italians use their arm gestures largely as intonation, underlining pauses, whereas in England you've got the opposite over there. Waving your hands around is a bit crass and even a bit rude. The English prefer to go for the ability to use language to express colourfully what they want to say and not the gestures about what they mean.
And I find the Irish a little bit more colourful with their language as well.
A little bit.
I'm saying that I'm putting it down a little bit.
Jason, you are, yes.
But there's a lot of connection there as well. So there's I think there's, as we say, there's a little bit of sensitivity, but as long as you understand the nuances within the countries that you're going to speak with or to, because I've had that opportunity to, like yourself, to speak to global audiences, and it's amazing. So when you're as a leader, as a sales leader, how can you build up a lot more confidence within you, but within your teams as well, and how you come across to them to create that instant connection, trust, but also the credibility that you are who you say you are, and you will lead them well to where they're going to be going? Because we are on the Global Sales Leader, but I'm interested in that, how we can get sales leaders, their non-verbals up to just make that connection a little bit better.
Well, look, the place that really stands out, Jason, is when you see a leader, an existing leader or currently newly appointed leader, go to stage to make their first presentation to the staff and to the audience. And the audience is looking at them and analysing everything they're doing to work out, does this person have confidence, power, authority? Should I bother following them? Do they know what they're talking about? And that's a pretty critical thing for a person to go on stage and do that. But fortunately, there are things that you can practice in body language of deleting negatives that might take away from your perceived power and authority and then add to it. So, for example, we know that world leaders, well, the trained ones, and some of these are clients of mine, we train them to do this. When they walk from a helicopter or a plane across the tarmac to a press meeting where all the cameras are rolling, we get them to walk in it's a semi-march. They're not marching, but it's a kind of a semi-march. You don't consciously notice they're doing it. But when you see a person in a semi-mask walking and the others aren't, your brain instantly says that person seems to be in charge. They seem to have the authority and the power. So walking across a stage or across any platform where there's cameras and people see you in a semi-mask will instantly make you stand out. And the places you'll see this, you might be at a business or social function and somebody walks in the room and they walk in a semi-mask. And everyone says, oh, who's that? They don't even know why they're saying who's that, just that the behavior of the semi-mask projects authority. That's the first thing. Now, the second thing, that the people who are leaders, who we generally like to think them as being relatively fearless, that they can lead us. They don't have much in the way of body crossing, particularly if they've been trained. They don't cross their arms on their chest unless they're trying to make a reinforced negative point and that reinforces it. But normally speaking, they don't have that as part of their repertoire. I don't have anybody crossing in part of my repertoire. I don't cross my arms, don't cross my ankles. I've trained myself out of that over the years. Now, while I was waiting for you before I'm sitting here on the chair, I did cross my arm because I strained my back the other day, and that just takes the pressure off a little bit. But if you didn't know that and you happen to see me, you'd say, oh, he's feeling a bit negative, a bit defensive about what's about our interview, because you don't really know why I'm doing it. Now, it doesn't matter why I'm doing it. What matters is the perception of the person who sees you doing it. So you see this in audiences, an audience sitting with their arms all crossed. When you get up as a speaker, and I do this regularly as you do, and when you see that, the audience are saying, convince me, what's this guy got to talk about? How blurring, and you've got to break that out pretty quickly.
So when question that, why we're there, and because I've read a lot, before we carry on, is upwards and then lower as well with crossing the arms, because I heard that was protecting the heart and protecting that, and also But having it a little bit lower.
Monkeys and chimps do that. Monkeys and chimps cross their arms when they're being threatened by others high up. It protects your heart and lungs from a frontal attack. And if you look at artwork throughout history, the time when people, particularly men, wore armor on the front, you never saw anybody crossing their arms. They didn't need to because they had the protection. But when the armor went and we're out in the open, crossing the arms is really about your only form of emotional security you've got. Now, it doesn't matter why you cross your arms. People say, oh, cross it because I'm comfortable. Well, look, body language is an outward reflection of emotions. If you're with a group of people, you don't know anybody, or you don't like what they're saying, or you've got a contrary opinion, you might cross your arms. You say, well, I'm not negative. I'm just quite comfortable. Of course you're comfortable, Jason, because you don't like what you're seeing, hearing, and experiencing. If you're with all your mates down the pub having a great old time, crossing your arms is uncomfortable.
Having arms crossed
flying around is comfortable because you're with people that you like and admire and reflect. So removing any crossings from the front as a leader is a great strategy. One you'll see with people on stage, especially men, more men than women, is the broken zipper position where they're holding hands with themselves in front of the zipper.
Yeah.
Now, the origin of that's interesting. When you're a kid, if your mum or dad or somebody who looked after you when you're a small child held your hand under tense situations like crossing a busy road, going to a new school, or in a big shopping center, if you were raised associating hand holding with security, so suddenly you're in front of a big audience, you go, holy hell, you know, the number one fear of most people in Western Europe and in Europe is standing in front of a group of people they don't know. That being the case, you're likely to hold hands with yourself, and that's what that is. Well, holding hands with yourself in front of your zip, you go, oh, thank you, Mum, I feel so much more secure now. Which is very nice, but the audience who sees you, particularly female brain people, pick this up unconsciously and they go, he's not very confident, he's feeling a bit nervous. So keep yourself uncrossed, which raises the question that frightens the terror out of people. Well, hang on, all my life I've been holding my hand in frustrating positions or lacing my fingers or crossing my arms or covering my fly with a broken zip position or lacing my fingers and legs together. This guy's telling me not to do it anymore. And people get very nervous about this. So you replace it with gestures that you are doing intentionally that will create an atmosphere in two areas. One, in yourself, so you feel good. And secondly, when a person sees you, they go, this guy seems to know what he's talking about. And one of them is what we call a steeple. I'm doing it now.
Yeah,
it's almost like you're praying with the fingers tapping back and forth.
Charles does that a lot. King Charles, should I say.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Charles. Charles, he's a cracker at doing that one. Now, Donald Trump, it's his favorite gesture. It's a typical gesture in the repertoire of about 10% of the population. The majority are not aware that they're doing it. But when you do this steeple gesture, you keep it below your chin. It goes above your chin. You start to look a bit arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
When you do it, just you do it now, Jason. Just copy. Okay, we're both doing the steeple. We just move it back and forth slowly. Now smile at me, but don't show any teeth. What are you feeling when you do this? You're feeling sneaky, right? You've got a plan.
Yeah.
You could fool me with something. And that's all being, I've intentionally asked you to take the gesture. And the gesture creates the attitude. This is the incredible thing about body language. It's an outward reflection of your emotions. It shows how you're feeling. So reading it, you just match their feelings with what they're saying and the circumstance under which it happens. But if you intentionally take gestures such as steepling or such as a forward march, a semi-march across the room, or holding the hand straight, giving the same pressure you receive. You intentionally do that. Two things happen. One is it makes you feel more confident, and the person who sees you or experiences this instantly gives you confidence points. They go, this person seems to know what they're about.
But it also gives you energy as well, because I like, probably like yourself, I like to have full energy when I'm with people, but obviously I have to tone it down when if I'm looking at their gestures. But also,
unless you're Italian.
Yes, yeah, unless you're Italian, then it's something slightly completely different, and then you have to really work hard exactly what they're trying to say. Yeah, well, that's totally different then. the other thing I was thinking about while we were speaking is the other nonverbal cues is the position of the legs, and especially where you're having a conversation as a leader and you have your team, is watching their position of their legs and where in relation to the door. Looking at that, obviously you have to be quite careful how you do that, but from what I've read from your books and other various other books on body language, if they're pointing towards the door, they want to get the hell out of there.
Well, in simple terms, the legs indicate the direction in which the mind would like to go.
Yeah.
Well, it's not actually the legs, it's the hips. So if you're with a small group of people talking and you say to yourself, oh, I'm fed up with this, I've had enough of this, how do I get out of here? Where's the exit? We've all done that. And so you spot the exit over there. So what will happen is you'll tilt your hips towards that exit, which means that your foot, your front foot, is oriented towards the door. Whereas if you're in a group, and I saw this the other night, there were three guys in it and one absolutely gorgeous woman, and they all had their foot pointed directly at her. They go, yeah. In other words, their mind was pointed to where she was. And women do the same. If a woman likes a guy, she'll do the same. She'll orient her hips towards him, which gives the effect that her front foot's pointing at him. So it's actually the hips that rotate. So if someone's got their hips rotated towards an exit or towards another group of people, but their head's pointed back towards you, the head's just trying to be polite. What they're saying is, yes, very nice. And they'll increase the head nodding from 3 nods to 5 nods, which means I'm out of here.
Yeah, that's really quite powerful, actually, to really sort of understand that, especially for the people that listen to this podcast, is really to get in tune with that, because especially if you're trying to build that rapport, trust, respect, and so on and so forth, credibility, likability, all that with your team, how do you pivot them back to where they need to be in that presence, that here and now, get them back on track, get them in line? And probably the unexperienced leaders out there probably need to listen wisely to your words now.
Well, let's go back to the leader who's on stage in front of a group of people who may have their arms crossed saying, oh, you're the new guy. What do you know? Why should I follow you? Which they're not saying that, but that's likely to be the attitude of many of them. If an audience has their arms crossed, they're showing any negative gestures, you don't start with talking about it. You start with a physical exercise. So, okay, let me just survey who's in the room today. How many of you have been working with the company for less than 1 year? Raise your hands. Everybody, please raise your hand. So now they raise a hand. Who's been here 1 to 3 years? Who's been this? Who's been there? Who's in the wrong room? They start laughing. So when they bring their hands down and their arms don't cross and they tilt their head 15 degrees, that's when you start the material. And that's where good salespeople know that when they should start talking, when they should not start talking, is by analyzing when the person's body language becomes open. Now, if you're in a boardroom, you've got a group of people sitting around a table and you're looking at them, they're starting to do negative gestures such as hand on the side of the face, supporting the head, a critical evaluation, one finger across the mouth, one up the side of the ear.
Yeah.
If you start to see those things, you could do the same thing. So, okay, everybody, let's stand up and have a break. So get them to physically change, because we know that by physically changing your body position, changing your behavior, it physically changes your attitude. So if people are sagging, their body signals will say they're sagging. So get them to physically change and do an exercise of some sort. And the internet's full of exercises you can do with audiences that are quick, easy, fun, and breaks them up. Give them a break to have a glass of water or a cup of tea or something. But physically change. Don't talk when the signals are showing that they're not buying.
Yeah, I was while you were speaking, I did a training course quite recently on sales, and I just saw that slump. So I just got them all to stand up, then all to walk around clockwise round the room, and I went, now walk anti-clockwise, and point at each other and start laughing.
And that's perfect.
It was amazing, the immediate impact. I know they're breathing deeply, and also the endorphins are kicking in with the body. But that just a huge makes a difference is standing
Absolutely. Look, you know, I had an audience the other day in Sydney, and they were mostly couples, small business, mostly couples, men and women. And I was the last speaker of the day. And they'd heard enough all day. They'd been battered by speaker after speaker. And I'm the last guy. Get up there, Alan, and make them laugh and have a great time and teach them something. And so I got up there, and they're all sitting with their arms crossed, and they're thinking, oh, God, how long's this guy going to go on for? But they were couples. So I said, okay, now, before I start, just raise your hand. How many of you are here with your partners? And majority put their hands up. I said, okay, your partner's sitting next to you. Raise your hand. They put their hands up again. I said, okay, now, I want you to turn to your partner. Each turn to each other and look them in the eyes. Do it right now. Now, anybody who doesn't do this is going to be asked to give a three-minute speech. Like, well, we're going to do this. So now they're all, I said, now stare into their eyes. Look into their eyes. They're all doing it. I said, you are now, it's been scientifically proven that you are now looking at the person who is most likely to murder you. It just fell apart. They're laughing and they're clapping and they're moving around, doing exactly what you did with your audience. I've broken them up. And the thing about doing these little exercises as a leader, you can practice and learn these things. The internet and books are full of these things. Yeah. You can learn to do little icebreakers like that are quick, easy, funny, and you give yourself credibility because clearly you've seen when people are sagging and they appreciate the fact that you fired them up.
Yeah. Pattern interrupts, as we would say in psychology, yeah. Just to make their unconscious shift. Question I always like to ask, if you are interviewing you to yourself and you were sitting next to you, what sort of question would you ask you?
What would I ask me?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the most asked question, and I'm thinking of the most asked question I would get, which comes in a variety of forms, but the bottom line is they want to know, how do you succeed in doing this wide range of things? I do a wide range of things. I had five totally different unrelated businesses that all operate at a really high level. How do you do all this stuff? Mm. And that, in simple terms, is the most asked question I guess I would get. And the answer is pretty straightforward. In fact, I wrote a book called The Answer that tackles this. Is most people in our societies, in Western society and European, Western European societies, we're raised in the area of goal setting, setting a goal, having a deadline, having a time limit, overcoming objections, obstacles, roadblocks, etc. You know, we all know that pretty well.
Yeah.
Everybody asks me, how do you do it? But the way the brain works is we don't have a how brain. What you've got to ask yourself is what? What do I want to do? What do I want to have? What do I want to become? What? If you can answer the what, then the how becomes apparent. Because the reticular activating system, the RADS, that sits on the top of the brainstem at the back of your brain, it's like a Google search engine. It searches the internet, if you like, the entire environment for the how. If you're trying to think about now, how would I become a great business leader? How would I become a good boss? How would I become a multimillionaire? How would I become a Buddhist monk or whatever your goal is? If you start with how, which is where Westerners and Europeans start, within 2 days, you become demotivated and nothing happens. You go back to what you know. And this is what happens with the majority of people. If you start with the what will I do, have, or become? So, for example, you drive a car, Jason?
I do, yeah.
What sort of car is it?
Yeah, I was trying to think. Then it's an Audi A4.
An A4, so it's a four-door?
Yeah.
What color?
Gray.
How long you had it?
5 years.
Like it?
Yes, all right. Gets me around.
The minute you decided to have an Audi A4 four-door car, you started seeing every second car on the road was an
absolutely.
Audi A4.
Yep.
You go to the airport out at Dublin, there's a big sign, Avis has a special on Audi A4s this month. You watch a James Bond movie, there's the getaway car. It's an Audi A4. Yep, everywhere you look, you drive down the street, someone's garage is open. Then there's an Audi A4 that come. You cannot stop seeing Audi A4s. And for everybody listening and watching this podcast, whatever car you've got, the minute you decide to get it, everybody's got one.
Absolutely.
Does that mean there's more A4s on the road after you decide to get one than before? No, what's the difference? Well, the RADS started searching the internet in space to look for the answers to the question. And this is what it does. And this is why you never have to think about how. How would I become whatever? How would I become this? How would I be? The how is going to screw. The fact the how's not out of your business. All you've got to do is say what. Here's what I will do. Have me come. Full stop. End of story. Over and out. No more discussion. Now, if your friends and and mates and family say, yeah, but how would you do that? How would you move to Dublin and set up a thing with Global? I mean, yeah, you come from Essex, Jason. I mean, come on, get a job down at the plant and you could be the foreman within 10 years. How could you do that? If people don't go along with you and don't support, if they keep asking how, you just don't tell them anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't mean
you don't love them if they're family. You just don't tell them. And we had a woman come to one of our seminars recently. This was a cracker. The day before she arrived, she just found out she's pregnant for the first time. And she's pretty excited. And she arrived here on the Sunshine Coast. And that night she went to the local plaza, local mall, to do some shopping and have a meal. And she came to our meeting next morning. She said, I cannot believe how many pregnant women and babies that are on the side. Everywhere I look, I see prams and pushes and babies and women. Like, is this a pretty horny sort of a place, she said. Well, no, there's no more babies here before she arrived pregnant than after. It's just that the minute babies and pregnancy became the what, she started to see it everywhere. So if you decide the what, you will see the how. You'll open a magazine, you'll turn on your computer. And I decided to learn to speak French. And I wanted to speak Russian as well. I lived in Russian collectively for nearly 5 years before the war and COVID. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'm going to learn to speak the basics.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'd never done this before as an older person. So I did catch myself saying, now how would I not? Hang on, no, wait a minute, not how. I will learn to speak French. I will learn to speak basic Russian. I'll learn to speak the basics of German and Japanese, my major markets. And so I opened my email next morning to do some email. You know how they have little windows down the side with all this stuff that comes out, they're trying to sell you stuff. Up comes this window. Want to learn a foreign language? Well, so I clicked it. I went through and I signed up on a free program, which then converted to $5 a month to learn how to speak French and then basic Russian. Now, I asked myself, how long has that window been appearing on my email? So I contacted the company and asked them. It had been coming up for 1 year on my screen, and I never saw it because I hadn't decided the what of speaking a foreign language.
Yeah.
And so the minute I decided the what, I saw the how. If you start with the how, you're searching your own databases within your brain, which is not much, it's limited, and you don't know how, and that's why you get demotivated and disappointed. Decide the what you'll do. You know, there's a big leap of faith there. You're deciding what you're going to do, have, or become without knowing how. The good news is you don't have to know how, you just have to know what. So the question I get asked is, how do you do this? And my answer is, no, what is it you want to do, have, or become? And decide that, write it down in handwriting, because there's 2.5 chances more than if you key it that's going to happen if you write it down. And when you're keying something, there's 8 to 10 connections of the brain operating. When you're handwriting, it's a signal for the brain, comes straight down your hand, out by pen or pencil. And so there's up to 2,000 connections operating, which means you're emotionally involved with handwriting. Tough for the under 30s now, Jason, because they don't write anymore. They key everything.
Yeah.
And so that's the most question. How would I do this? And to which my response is, no, what do you want to do? I clarify the what. And once they clarify the what, I get response. I can't believe it. I went back home, I turned TV on, and here's this program about it. Well, that program was probably always there. That commercial was always there. But your brain never saw it because you hadn't decided the what. You're trying to work
out
the
blinkers on.
That's right. Don't decide the how. Decide the what.
I always like to say, whatever you program into your mind, your brain will find the answer. So however you suggest it. And if you write
it on the back of the brainstem, that's a rat. It's a system that has a GPS in it and a Google search engine.
Yeah. That's, and your brain will find the answer. So whether you believe you can or you can't, I know that's a bit of an old legendary way of saying things, your brain will find the answer. It's so powerful. And I've proven it to myself on many, many, many occasions, especially when I'm doubting myself. It's to write it down and go, I can do this. This is what I'm good at.
Yes.
And you ask yourself some good, positive ways of doing stuff. And your brain will find the answer, whether it's positive or negative, because our brain is that big superhuman computer. Like I heard
you only tell it to people who you trust will support you. If they keep asking you, yeah, but how? You're a young guy from Essex. How? Just don't tell them anymore.
What do I need to do?
Don't love them. You just don't tell them. Because look, if you decide, and I'm thinking now of a woman who came to one of our, we have a conference center here on the Sunshine Coast on our property where we run conferences for small people, for people over a weekend, 2-day course on how to do all this stuff. And one of the things that we talk about with the how is, is you write down the what, not the how. And yeah. One of the women came along, she was 42 years of age. She worked for a very large bank here, middle management, senior position, good salary, had a company car, all the perks that many people would like. But she was absolutely, she was a round peg in a square hole. She didn't like it at all, but she stayed there because she had the money. Two sons were at university, and she was divorced, so she's on her own. Yeah. And on the list that we get people to write out, she wrote down, help the orphans of Zimbabwe. And we hadn't seen that before. So we said, Helen, what's that about? She said, well, I've been watching these ads on TV that they want you to contribute $10 a month because 50% of orphans, 50% of kids under 12 in Zimbabwe are orphans because their parents died of AIDS. A big AIDS epidemic wiped them out. She said, and I'm touched by that. I want to do more. I want to do more than $10. So we said, well, what do you want to do? She said, well, I don't know how I'd do it, though. It's in Africa. I said, forget the how. What would you do? And so she started writing out the what's. Anyway, 3 months later, she quits the bank. Well, she took a 12-month leave. She moved to Africa. Now she's living in a tent with Medicine Sans Frontières in Nigeria. And she's been there for 3 years. And she's as happy as a pig in mud. She said, I was born to do this. She's no longer with the bank. Now, her family, I'm sure they don't like me because before she came to the bank, before she came to our seminar, she had a nice salary and a nice car. But she was unhappy and didn't want to do that. So you might be in some occupation where you've got a nice salary, a nice car and title on the wall. But if you don't like it, get out of it. Do what it is you want. Yeah, but how would I do it? It doesn't matter how you'll do it. Decide what. And you too could be in a tent in Nigeria on the ground.
It's connect your passion to your purpose to your dreams, which is a favorite Zig Ziglar quote, which always resonates in my head.
That's exactly right.
It is one of those things that how do you let me reframe.
How do you find out what it is, the what is?
I'm actually thinking of what do you need to do to get people's passion up, especially when they're in sales? What can you do?
You mean the buyer's passion or the salesperson's passion?
The salesperson's passion. How can you light that fire? Because I'm fascinated by this. Their intrinsic motivation. What do we need to do to get that out of them, to get that fire in their belly?
Yes. Having clearly defined goals is the answer to that. Somewhere in the, now your goals have got to be scary. If your goals don't scare you, they're a waste of time. They've got to be out of reach, not out of sight, but out of reach, to the point where you go, holy cow, am I really going to do this? And that will fire up with fear. Now, you don't want so much fear that it's immobilizing you. Like if you want to be a billionaire, that scares the hell out of you. Start with being a millionaire. That's more practical. That's like a studio apartment in London, probably. So you start on small things and go to bigger things by setting clearly defined goals in the future. You get motivated by visualizing the end results. And this is important because as you're heading towards that goal, as you come across obstacles and roadblocks, which you do, there's obstacles, roadblocks, there's dips, cars are going to run over you, people are going to get you from behind. That's the way it actually goes in life. When those things occur, you'll jump around them, jump over them, get around them, talk them out of it, because you're motivated by focusing on the end result. If the end result, the goal you want, is not crystal clear, you'll be motivated by the next thing that jumps in front of you. That's what happens to most people. They're motivated by the next thing that happens. And in chasing worthwhile goals that scare you, most of those things initially will not be positive. They'll be negative. Like you try to get a big goal and people will try and stop you. They will. And we did a couple of tests with people at our seminar who wrote some pretty impressive goals and things they wanted to do. We said, well, look, if you go and tell your family members that you're going to go to Africa with Medicine Sans Frontières and live in a tent, what will they say? So she rang three of them and they said, oh, the Hutu going to cut your head off and you'll get AIDS and then the snakes will bite you and the spiders will kill you and you'll starve to death and you'll get hepatitis, you get raped and suffer from AIDS. Well, look, are those things realistic? Yes. When you're tackling any large goal, it involves risks of some sort. Yeah. That's why there's fear there. But look, if you're not frightened of the goal enough to make you run, then you won't run. You'll just stay where you are and in the place you are. And so, it's funny talking about this. The amount of people we've sent to live in tents around the world. Because the bottom line, now to work out what is the thing that you want to do with your life.
Yeah.
That's a good question that I get a lot of. It's sort of a combination of the questions you ask. Was you write out a list in handwriting of everything in your entire life you ever wanted to do. something you saw, thought, or behaved when you were younger. You said, wouldn't it be great to do that, have that, go there, or become that? And you didn't do it. You didn't do it, Jason, because life got in the way. You had kids, got married, got a promotion, had a big mortgage, etc. And we've all got reasons why life gets in the way. So you write a list of everything that motivates you, and you just keep adding to it every day. And after a while, some of the things in that list start to jump out. It's like they go bold. And it's really amazing how this affects your brain. What they're saying is, pick me, pick me, pick me. Yeah. And some things you might have had in your head for years, suddenly you can't see them anymore. They've disappeared. That means that they weren't relevant. They were at one time, but they're not now. So you put a line through them when you see them. And ask the question, of all the things in your life you could do, Jason, what is the one thing, if you could do it every day, you love it so much, it's so exciting, you do it for free. Yeah. In fact, you can't wait to wake up tomorrow morning and go and do it. If you can pinpoint what that thing is or those things are, that's where your greatness lies, right there. Yeah, but I don't know how I'd make money out of it, make a career. And we had one of our women said that. She said one of the things she wanted to do was home entertainment parties. She was good at putting on parties and making people feel great. She said, yeah, but how do you make money out of this? I don't know where to start. Well, Martha Stewart didn't know either. She just decided that's what she's going to do. Now she's a multi-billionaire from doing it. Yeah, and one guy, he was a bit of a smart ass. He says to me, but I like beating people up. How do you make a go around that? So did Mike Tyson. He made 500 million. He lost it all, but he made 500 million. If you decide something that you love so much, you do it for nothing, then you will never work another day in your life. And there are hundreds of thousands of people doing that. Like I remember Bjorn Borg when I met him. All he wanted to do was hit tennis balls and win. He never knew how much money he made. He did. He's a very wealthy guy, but he didn't know how much money he made. He just got up and hit balls, and wanted to win. And he became famous. And he said, I don't work, I play tennis.
Ah, that's awesome. Something that I did this year, I set my intention last year to run 50K, which is 31 miles.
Yes.
But I set the bigger intention and the higher purpose is to run it over mountains.
Uh-huh.
And the next intention is to raise funds for men's mental health because I wanted to give something back in the way of the higher purpose for me was to inspire my kids. So I had a big picture and actually achieved it this year. And I ran it. It's a big achievement for me anyway, to run 31 miles, 50K over the mountains. And it was a running event. And I've never done that. I've never run a marathon before. But I achieved the marathon.
That's great.
And I achieved the goal. And I achieved the three aspects that I wanted to achieve. So you have to have those and have those relatable stories for your teams as well.
All my life, I wanted to go on a submarine under the ice.
Oh, wow.
There's never been any such thing. But now there is. And so on 1st of December this year, I'm going in a mini glass submarine under the icebergs in Antarctica.
Wow.
It's all booked and ready to go. You can now do Arctic tourism in a submarine. And I posted it on my social media. So this is what I'm going to do, goal number 168. And half the people said, you've got to be crazy. Didn't you see what happened to that sub with the Titanic? They went down, they got dissolved. Well, we're not going to go 4 kilometers. If you go 4 kilometers underwater, well, yeah, you're probably going to get dissolved. We might go maybe 250 meters below the icebergs and around. Yep. And so I've weighed up all the risks on it. And it's more a mental thing than anything, because it's a mental thing of being in a small glass bubble. And when it comes to claustrophobia, I'm not real good on that, Jason. I'm not.
Yeah.
So I've been scaling my brain as to see, so I can see myself in that sub. I can see myself doing it. And I can see myself enjoying it. Because if I didn't do that, then the claustrophobic feelings might take over. And I will do it, and it'll be goal number 168. Someone said, what's goal number 169? I said, to resurface.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a really – I'd like to see that big in my head, a big picture in my mind of that. And it is seeing it, believing it, and actually visualizing it, because there's a lot of research and data behind that. If you visualize something enough, it becomes, it can come true, but you have to see it in your brain to make sure that you see it happening. For me, it was at the most struggling point of running up the last mountain on the way back is to see my kids at the finishing line. And that actually happened. And I saw it exactly the same way as I imagined it to become. And for all of those sales leaders out there that want to visualize and see things actually happen, obviously, they see it, feel it, and do it, but then they have to challenge it and make that goal actually happen.
Well, back to your original question on how do you motivate yourself in sales. At the basis of it is decide the what. What is it you will achieve as a goal or become as a goal? And when it's crystal clear in the future and it's out of reach, but not out of sight, and so you're pretty nervous, you're fired up. If you're not fired up and tense, you're just going to not succeed at anything. And so you head for that. And when things get in, obstacles and things get in the way, which they do, they're not going to phase you. You'll jump around and go over, kick them out of the way if you need to get to the goal. If the goal's not clear, there's no goal, then it's you're going to be motivated by what happens next. And in chasing worthwhile goals, what happens next is normally more negative than positive.
Yeah. Look, this has been absolutely incredibly wonderful, interesting, fantastic conversation that we've had. I
heard under the ice. Come on.
Yeah, I'm not thinking about that now. That's a negative content. I'd love to do something like that. That's obviously something else that. But I have a few other steps I need to take before I stick myself up in a submarine and do something like that. But
you've
I heard a
really want it. You've got to really want to do it.
And
yesterday I set up one of my goals I've had for a long time, and that is to live forever. And I'm one of the founding members of the first cryonics facility in Australia. We had a dry run yesterday. So when I die, eventually I'll be put in cryonics on ice, and I'll be brought back in somewhere between, 30 to 50 years, as I had to say. I'll be come back probably on a USB stick and go into a robot, but that's good. So I'll go on pause.
Well, imagine how much more you can teach the world based on all of your experience.
Come back as a young person knowing what you know now. Wow, isn't that the best?
Oh, yeah, I think that's what everyone wants to do when they come on. I'm in 50 now, so going back in time and just reinstalling, re-engaging the brain of what you know and then starting over again, that'd be a fascinating
thing. Well, we're almost to the point of being able to do brain downloading. It's very close. I mean, in the last decade or so, there's been big moves forward, and people like Stephen Hawking was an example who could control computers and run things just by thought. And the extension of that is going to be brain downloading, where we download your brain and put it on an icon on a computer. And as soon as we can do that, then we can put that anywhere we like. And in the case of, say, Elon Musk, when he does it, he's going to be shot through the black hole to another galaxy somewhere and live on another planet as a 3D print. So the future is it's just opening up so fast because in January this year, who ever heard of ChatGPT? Nobody. But now it is a force of the world. 25 years ago, we told you that in your hand, at age 50, you would hold the world's knowledge and be connected to billions of people. You would have said, Jason, lock that guy up. He's on drugs.
Yeah.
But now it's normal.
That's now, now it's just every day.
We don't even think about it.
Absolutely incredible, Alan. I've really thoroughly enjoyed every single moment of this. How can people find out more about you? And before I say anything more, I understand that you've run a course. We've got a course. I know you have. On Mind Valley. mindvalley.com/body language for all the people that are viewing this, but for majority of the people that are listening to this, you've also got a course on there. And how can people find out more about you?
Well, it's two ways. First is Mind Valley. We cut 17 films for Mind Valley. And I built a TV studio here on my property during COVID because we thought the future was not going to be about big meetings. It will be about doing things like podcasts like we're doing right now, which has turned out to be the case. So we cut that film here. Mind Valley is certainly the most thorough and most how-to hands-on body language program ever recorded. I'm really, really happy with that one. To find out about what we do personally and our courses, books, and video training, etc., go to pease.tv, P-E-A-S-E, my name, .tv, and it's all will be revealed.
Awesome. I look forward to that. And I also look forward to reading your other books as well.
Cool.
So thank you once again. You've listened to the Global Sales Leader podcast. Every week I speak to phenomenal guests from around the globe that are making an impact. The way I like to always do it, if you can take one golden nugget out of every single podcast and apply it, and ask that wonderful question, what, how I can apply this, and then do it and practice it and rehearse it. So thank you once again. Wow. Thank you for tuning into this illuminating episode of the Global Sales Leader Podcast with Alan Pearce and your host, me, Jason Cooper. But before I wrap up, here are a few takeaways. Connect with me. If you'd like to reach out more, find out more about what I do, explore my valuable insights, come and visit my website, jasoncooper.io. There you'll find a wealth of resources, including articles, podcasts, and information about my training and coaching services. My podcasts are making waves and reaching new heights. To stay up to date with the latest episodes and gain access to a treasure trove of knowledge from thought leaders across various eclectic industries, be sure to subscribe to my podcast on your favorite platform, and including on this YouTube as well. I'm growing that phenomenally. And explore the wealth of my training, over 25 years of sales experience, co-founding 2 startups and working with corporates, companies, and small to medium-sized businesses. So explore all the eclectic array of different types of services that I offer. And please stay connected by the usual channels, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram.